This is lecture number 12 by Alan McCrae and the Prophecies of Daniel. Lecture number 12. Now, I have taken more time in reviewing certain sections of Daniel than I had expected to. I think it's wise to get well in mind the material we are covering. It means that there are four verses, though, which are quite unrelated in most ways to the rest of the prophecy, which I had thought I would be able to spend 2 or 3 hours on. In such a case, I wish you would write out any questions and get them to me, if possible, ahead of class, or at least before the class starts. Now, we have looked at the history of Antiochus Epiphanes, or Antiochus the Fourth, and we have seen how precise statements about him are found in Daniel chapter 11. The idea that chapter 11 ends and all of a sudden chapter 12 has an unmentioned interval jumping forward to Antichrist would be rather ridiculous, because the preceding verses tell us about Antiochus Epiphanes, his ancestors, and his brother in so much detail, and there's not much point to it except leading up to this terrible crisis that was faced by Judaism in the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. And this terrible crisis is described by the long account of the reign of Antiochus Epiphanes, which was section D of the outline. And then in section E, we already spoke about Daniel chapter 11, verses 36 to chapter 12, verse 3. Under that we notice, number 1, quote, the king's character and career, end quote. I mentioned a number of points in which it was quite obvious that most of the material from chapter 11, verse 36 to chapter 12, verse 3 could not possibly be considered as a continued account of Antiochus. Those, however, who hold a Maccabean view of Daniel's authorship either say that these are the guesses of the writer that might happen in the future, or else they say that these things that we read about actually happened, but that we have no historical record of it, so that the particular events described in these verses just don't fit anything we know about Antiochus Epiphanes. The account of the character of this man, described in chapter 11, verse 36, through chapter 12, verse 3, is utterly different from Antiochus, however, who had built great temples to the gods of his fathers. Yet this one, in these verses that I've been describing, we are told, disregards all the gods of his fathers and turns away from them. And we also notice that this one, who will honor the god of fortresses, is a good expression for a purely materialistic viewpoint, which would have been rather incomprehensible for people in ancient times, but which today fits exactly well with those who have a materialistic philosophy, mainly communist nations and communist leaders. Now, we also discuss number 2 in the outline, quote, the time of trouble and deliverance, end quote. We look briefly at that. This very terrible time that is described in chapter 11, verse 36 to chapter 12, verse 3, which could be taken as describing the time of the crisis under the Maccabees, but since we have a description of a very different situation, it is more reasonable to take this passage as something that is yet to happen in connection with a different person than Antiochus. Yes, a much later person than Antiochus. And then we notice in number 3, we notice that chapter 12, verse 2, describes a general resurrection. And so, if this section goes clear to the resurrection, it is obvious there must be a very long, unmentioned interval, at least 2,000 years, since the resurrection has not yet occurred, so there are 2,000 years between the account of Antiochus Epiphanes and the end of time. It would be rather absurd to put the unmentioned interval just before the mention of the resurrection. It is much more logical to put it in the place, as we did, between verses 35 and 36, though some have suggested other points at which to place this unmentioned interval. Now, that was capital E of the outline, and I want to go on now and take a glance at capital F, which is, quote, Daniel chapter 12, verses 4 to 13, end quote. And as we have noticed, chapters 10 to 12 are one unit, and it is very unfortunate that the archbishop made the division of chapter 11 where he did. Now, if he had made it one verse later, in verse 2 of chapter 11, it would have been a very reasonable division, though actually it's one continuous passage. That is, chapters 10 to 12 are one passage, one unit. And so, chapter 12, verse 4 to 13, I want to say a few words about verse 4 to begin with. I will read this verse from the New International Version, or NIV. Verse 4 says, quote, "But you, Daniel, close up and seal the words of the scroll until the time of the end. Many will go here and there to increase knowledge." End quote. Now that's how the NIV translates it. The King James translates it a little more ambiguously. They render verse 4 as, quote, "But thou, O Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book even to the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased." End quote. There's not a great difference between the two versions in the wording, but a tremendous difference in the meaning. As it stands in the King James Version, it says, quote, "Shut up the words and seal the book even to the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased." End quote. Now, here's an interesting historical note. Isaac Newton, one of the greatest physicists that ever lived, wrote a discussion of Daniel, and in his description, he said that this statement describes how things would come to pass in the latter days, that many would go to and fro. There would be traveling, such as the world has never seen, he said. In fact, he said, I wouldn't be surprised to see people travel as fast as 60 miles an hour. And Voltaire, the great French atheist, said that Newton's commentary on Daniel was a good example of how, when a great scientific mind turns to the study of the Bible, his mind turns to mush. Voltaire said, "How could anybody travel 60 miles an hour? They wouldn't even be able to take their breath. They would die immediately." And of course, we know now how completely wrong Voltaire was. We know that what Newton thought was a tremendous leap in thinking on his part, but today it's quite commonplace. But actually, that's not the kind of travel, or even travel, that the passage is talking about at all. It doesn't mean that there will be a great increase in people going back and forth in the sense of traveling. It is definitely related to the first part of the verse, that Daniel is to seal up the book until the days approach when the statements in the book are immediately relevant to people's situation. And then many will hunt back and forth, and knowledge shall be increased. Let's go back to the NIV. It says, quote, "to increase knowledge," end quote. Now, both interpretations of the Hebrew are possible, but I think the King James says that as they hunt back and forth, they are going to find more understanding of what the passage means. And those who hunt back and forth are those who are looking at the prophecy at a later time, trying to understand what it means. The NIV simply says, in order to try to get more understanding of what it means, people will go back and forth through the prophecy. I think perhaps in this regard, the King James is a little better there, but the NIV in the first part is much clearer than the King James is, quote, "travel to and fro," end quote. It is the same Hebrew word used in 2 Chronicles chapter 16, verse 9, where we read, quote, "The eyes of the Lord go to and fro throughout the earth in order to observe the good and the wicked," end quote. It hasn't to do with traveling, but it's a hunting, a searching, a seeking for, and this is the sense that we take this verse to be in Daniel. We have a number of important things to look at here. And there is some of this that is not very clear nor exact in what it means. Daniel is told that the greater part of the purpose of his predictions is for a time in the future, quite a distant time off. Now, those who hold the Maccabean view hold that this whole passage was written during the time of the Maccabees by someone who pretended to be Daniel, telling things for that period but pretending it was prophecy. And that would fit. The prophecy would be a long distance off, to be sure, to have been written around 530 BC and have it look forward to events around 160 BC is a period of about four centuries later, and that, indeed, is a very, very long distance off. If someone had predicted events occurring now in the time of the Pilgrim Fathers, that would be very difficult to do. He'd certainly be looking way ahead. And so there is much in the book that looks way ahead to the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. But of course, as we found in chapter 11, there is also a great deal that looks way beyond the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. And of course, the interesting thing is that we start our prophecy with chapter 2, where we see the complete destruction of the statue representing human government through all the years, and that complete destruction of all human governments depicted in chapter 2 has not yet come. That indeed is in the future. So Daniel's prophecies begin with a look way on, even thousands of years into the future. But then in later chapters, he looks at the great crisis that comes at an earlier time, that is the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, which is earlier than the time of the very end, the time of the Antichrist. And now I've given you a couple of assignments on chapter 8. But we have not looked into chapter 8, and chapter 8 is the parallel to those other chapters which I thought it was good to leave until after our discussion of Antiochus Epiphanes under chapter 11 instead of chapter 8. Although in some ways chapter 8 is clearer about Antiochus Epiphanes than is chapter 11. Each chapter tells us a good deal about Antiochus, but there's no contradiction between the statements. Various aspects are emphasized in them. And so I want now to turn to chapter 8. And under that, 8, I have, quote, the setting, end quote. I want to bring out the fact that chapter 2 is given in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar, which is 602 BC, and then the next prophetic vision we have is at least 45 years later. I say it's the first year of Belshazzar, which is 556 BC or later. And you know the reason why I say or later. It is because we have no record of the time when Belshazzar actually became king. We know his father Nabonidus became king in 556 BC, if I recall correctly. But Nabonidus, at some time in his reign, made his son co-king with him. That is, he made Belshazzar co-king with himself. I would think it unlikely that he did it immediately, but he certainly did it at least a few years before the conquest by Cyrus in 539 BC. And so the first year of Belshazzar is either 556 or later, and 45 years are passed at least after chapter 2. And then after chapter 2 is written some 45 years later, as I said, we have Daniel's vision in chapter 7, which not merely shows the fourth kingdom, which is discussed in chapter 2, and not merely tells about the complete destruction of human government as predicted, but in addition to that, it shows something of the latter days before that destruction. It tells about the little horn that fights against the saints and prevails against them until the Ancient of Days comes and gives the victory to the saints and destroys entirely and completely the beast that was represented by the little horn. And then, in the third year of Belshazzar, which is 2 years later, we have this eighth chapter. That is, we have the third year of Belshazzar is the beginning of chapter 8. The ninth chapter now says at the beginning, quote, in the first year of Darius the Mede, who was made king over the realm of Babylon, end quote, and the statement, quote, was made king, end quote, should make it rather obvious that Darius the Mede was not the great emperor, but was Cyrus's representative. Now, Professor D.J. Weissman thinks that this is just another name for Cyrus, that is, Darius the Mede is another name for Cyrus the Great. It seems more likely, however, that this Darius the Mede is one who was spoken of in Cyrus's inscriptions as Gobirus. At any rate, he was a man who was made king over Babylon under the great emperor Cyrus. He evidently did not hold that position many years. In fact, it says that he was quite elderly when he received the kingdom, because chapter 10 begins in the third year of Cyrus the Persian, which would be about 537 BC. And so chapter 8 is the third year of Belshazzar. And now for number 2 of the outline, I have, quote, Shushan, end quote. Now, it says in the King James Version that Daniel's vision was at the palace of Shushan. The NIV says, quote, "In my vision I saw myself in the citadel of Susa," end quote. Now, Shushan is what the Hebrew has. Susa is the way the NIV takes it, which is a city about 200 miles east of Babylon in Persia, or Iran. The fact is that both are true, because the ancient Babylonians wrote the word as Shushan, but we have pretty good evidence that they didn't pronounce it as Shu, they pronounced it Su. So while it is actually written in the Hebrew as Shushan, Susa is how they actually pronounced it. And Susa was a great capital of a regime that had fought the Assyrians for many years, though finally conquered by them. It was probably part of the area held by Cyrus at the time when Daniel had this vision. And so, the fact that Daniel saw himself in this palace, to which he had probably gone in the past as a diplomatic representative, and now sees himself over there, is a suggestion of great changes to come. On to number 3 of the outline, quote, "The order of presentation," end quote. This we need not linger over much, because it was an assignment I gave you some time ago to look at chapter 8 and to note how much was vision and how much was interpretation. Now, verses 2 to 12 is a vision, and then while Daniel still sees the vision, he hears a saint ask another a question, and the other saint answers. Now, you might say that is still part of the vision, but I've simply listed it separately here as verses 13 to 14. And then we have 5 verses given, verses 15 to 19, where God asks the angel Gabriel to explain the vision to Daniel. And Gabriel says he will explain it to Daniel, and so verses 20 to 26 are the interpretation of the vision given by Gabriel. And then the final verses are Daniel's reaction. He was tremendously upset, as we read in the last verse of this vision. Now, we will call capital B as part of the vision proper, quote, "the two beasts," end quote. We have here two animals described that are very different from the animals in chapter 7. In verses 3 to 8, we have them described. In verses 20 to 22, we have the interpretation of them. And instead of the ferocious-looking beasts described in chapter 7, we have a goat and we have a ram. And the first one goes butting his way, pushing and covering the ground, going across the earth towards the west and the north and the south. That's a good description of Cyrus's conquests. The goat is described as coming from the west and going so fast that he hardly touches the ground. It fits exactly. And so we have the description of Alexander the Great's rapid conquest of Cyrus's former empire. Cyrus's conquests indeed were tremendous, but Alexander the Great's were much faster. These verses describe both rather vividly. We won't take time to go into them in detail, but we notice that in the interpretation in verses 20 to 22, that the NIV reads, quote, "The two-horned ram that you saw represents the kings of Media and Persia." Just a side note, notice that Media and Persia are again mentioned together. As I continue, "The shaggy goat is the king of Greece, and the large horn between his eyes is the first king. The four horns that replace the one that was broken off represent four kingdoms that will emerge from his nation, but will not have the same power," end quote. That would seem to make it very definite that this is a picture of the same events that are described in chapter 7 and again described again in chapter 11. But then we have something new in Daniel chapter 8. Here we find that we are confused by the fact that the King James Version speaks of a little horn. The NIV says, quote, "Out of one of them came another horn, which started small but grew in power," end quote. Now that's quite a difference from the King James's little horn. Actually, in chapter 7, where we had the little horn that represents the Antichrist, the word, quote, "little horn," end quote, there was in Aramaic, and literally it means a horn, a little one. But here the wording in the Hebrew is, quote, "a horn from littleness," end quote. And A Horn from Littleness, the NIV, has very well described by saying, quote, another horn which started small but grew, end quote. What do we mean by a horn from littleness? It could point to an opposition away from littleness. This Hebrew preposition is used in these two senses of from or away. It shows origin from, or it shows opposition, as in the sense of more than. And so, if you look at a horn more than littleness, you could mean a strong horn, and the ancient Greek translation here renders it a strong horn. Now, I think probably the NIV interpretation is the more accurate one, a horn that begins little and became great. But it is not the same terminology as we find in chapter 7. Now, the holder to the Maccabean interpretation, of course, would say the little horn in chapter 7 is Antiochus Epiphanes, and so he is the little horn also in chapter 8. They're both Antiochus Epiphanes. Well, in chapter 7, the little horn comes out of the fourth kingdom. In chapter 8, it comes out of the Greek kingdom, which is the third kingdom, and this horn from littleness describes Antiochus Epiphanes, who did not have a right to the throne, but who came in with a small force and managed to get control. We have discussed this historical fact before. So the tendency of the critics to try to equate the two is one we must avoid. But that doesn't mean that we should go to the opposite extreme and say wherever it speaks of a great enemy of God, it always describes Antichrist, because we have two great crises in the book of Daniel. The prophecies look forward to Antiochus Epiphanes, a long way off, nearly four centuries after the time of Daniel wrote, and we look forward to the coming of Antichrist at least 2,000 years after that. And so we have two different crises described. The little horn in chapter 8 comes out of the third kingdom, not the fourth kingdom as in chapter 7. So in chapter 7, we look forward to a great crisis that has yet to occur. Here we're looking at a great crisis that did occur in the time of the Maccabees. And so the account tells us about how Antiochus Epiphanes, or Antiochus IV, came from one of the parts of Alexander's empire. It describes his arrogance, and it says that he caused sacrifice to cease. Chapter 8, verse 12 says the daily sacrifice was taken away. He did take away the daily sacrifice, and we find exactly how that was fulfilled in Antiochus Epiphanes, who so polluted the temple that no pious Jew could enter it, so the regular morning and evening sacrifices were no longer made. Antiochus Epiphanes also put up a statue of Jupiter and polluted the temple even more, and the Maccabean revolt eventually resulted in the Jews getting control of the temple again and taking out the altar that had been polluted by Antiochus. And so this is a description of Antiochus Epiphanes then. All these things were precisely fulfilled by Antiochus Epiphanes. And yet it is strange, we mustn't go to the other extreme from the critics and say that every time it speaks of a great enemy of God in these passages, it's speaking about the Antichrist. But there are many who find it difficult to think that chapter 8 is simply talking about the great crisis under Antiochus IV. That is indeed only what is described here, however. But they think that the Antichrist must in some way be involved in chapter 8 as well, just as he's very clearly involved in chapter 7, and he's very clearly involved in chapter 11. In fact, both Antiochus and the Antichrist are very clearly involved in chapter 11, as we have seen before. But there are many who insist that he must also be, that is, the Antichrist must also be, in chapter 8 as well. Some have even gone so far as to say the vision here is about Antiochus Epiphanes, but that the interpretation's all about the Antichrist. Well, since the interpretation starts with saying that they represent the kings of Media and Persia and the king of Greece that is described, it seems ridiculous to take the view that we have the Antichrist discussed here, since he did not come during any of these kingdoms. And so a larger number will say that this is describing Antiochus Epiphanes, but that he is a type of Antichrist. It seems to me that we introduce unnecessary confusion in the scripture when we make some future thing a type of some other thing that is yet more in the future, if there is no scriptural statement that says this is the case. It seems to me to be quite clear that here in chapter 8, we are talking about Antiochus Epiphanes and Antiochus Epiphanes only. Now, the reason why many feel that this chapter 8 must be about the Antichrist is verses 17 and 19. I'll read them from the NIV, starting with verse 16, and I quote, "I heard a man's voice from the Ulai calling, 'Gabriel, tell this man the meaning of the vision.' And he came near the place where I was standing. I was terrified and fell prostrate. 'Son of man,' he said to me, 'understand that the vision concerns the time of the end.'" End quote. Well, that phrase, quote, "the time of the end," end quote, can suggest a time at the end of the age. But the expression "end" is used in Scripture in many different ways. Quote, "the end of your faith," end quote. Quote, "you are receiving the end of your faith in the salvation of your souls," end quote, says the New Testament. It can speak of the end of somebody's reign or the end of some situation. It means it concerns something that is not yet in Daniel's time, that it is quite a distance forward, but not necessarily at what we call the end times, but rather something that is going to be an end, not the end. There are many cases where this word very obviously does not refer to the very end of the ages. And so, we continue in verse 19. Gabriel said, quote, "I'm going to tell you what will happen later in the time of wrath because the vision concerns the appointed time of the end," end quote. And one commentary says that nothing ended at the time of the Maccabees, and so it must look forward to the Antichrist. But of course, that's an erroneous statement, quote, "nothing ended at the time of Antiochus," end quote. The persecution that Antiochus began, the great persecution, came to an end when the Maccabees gained their freedom, and they set up in Judea a separate state. Or if you want something bigger than that to come to an end, the captivity began, as you know, in the time of the taking of Jerusalem, and the exile began in 586 BC. The exile ended in 538 BC because Cyrus the Great gave a decree a year before that the people who desired would go back and could rebuild the city of Jerusalem. And so the exile ended there, but not the captivity, because there were still Jews under the control of the Persians. And they continued under their control until Alexander the Great destroyed the Persian Empire, and then Palestine was under the control of the Ptolemies after Alexander died, and it was under the control of the Ptolemies for about 100 years. Then it was under the control of the Seleucids. So the captivity continued till the time of the Maccabees, but the captivity ended with the Maccabees. They had about 100 years of being an independent state before the Romans took it over. And so it certainly is, quote, "time of an end," end quote, of a very vital development in the history of Israel. Notice it is the end of a time, not the end of time. Well, while there's more detail that would be interesting in this chapter if we had considerable time, I would like to take the statements of Antiochus in the first part of the vision and parallel them with the statements in the interpretation. And that's very interesting to see how each one of them gives us some information that is not given in the other. But I don't think we will take time for that now, since the semester really is drawing to a close. And I would like to put on the board now for a minute or so a brief outline of these four different chapters that we have discussed up to this point. That would be chapters 2, 7, 8, and 11. Now, this outline doesn't cover anything but what I've already looked at, but perhaps it will make things a little bit more vivid for you. So here we go. In Daniel chapter 2, we have the four parts of the statue, or the five parts, of which the last two are joined together. In chapter 7, the four animals, then followed by the little horn. In chapter 2, we have the complete destruction of the statue. In chapter 7, the beast of which the little horn is part is completely destroyed, and his body is given to the fire. And then the new kingdom, in chapter 2, we have towards the end, with the rock being cut out without hands, and then we have the Son of Man's coming to his kingdom in chapter 11. Now, one of the suggested questions I put here is, quote, what is said about the saints in the book of Daniel, end quote. And we find that as we looked at one place this morning. In chapter 8, we heard a saint inquire of another. Now, whether that word saint means a holy one or a saint, we don't know exactly what it refers to here, but the word saint is used several times in chapter 7, where the Antichrist fights against the saints and is about to destroy them, but the Ancient of Days comes and the kingdom then is given to the saints. The Son of Man is also given a kingdom. He shall reign. It's a kingdom that cannot be destroyed, but the kingdom is given to the saints. There is at least a part of the time when the Son of Man reigns in power over the earth, when the saints are his representatives in that power. You find many people talking about the eternal age. Some say that there can be no millennium when Christ comes back. There must be only an eternal age because the kingdom, we are told, cannot be destroyed. It's the kingdom of Christ. Well, it is quite plain that the kingdom of Christ cannot be destroyed, but there is no reason it cannot change its form in one way or another as he might choose. And so the kingdom of the saints would seem to last for a long time. Basically, a long time of 1,000 years, if we believe that there's a millennium, but what is after that, we really don't know. We do not find the words eternal state anywhere in Scripture. I think they are a philosophical conception that has no solid basis. I see no evidence that time comes to an end. Time is simply the possibility of things following one another, and there's no reason to think that things can't follow one another after what we call the Great White Throne Judgment. But God has not revealed to us what will happen then. But notice in chapter 8, I put the ram a little lower down in the picture here because it doesn't tell us in chapter 8 which of the animals or parts of the statue the ram corresponds to. But the description makes it very clear that it is the second kingdom and that the he-goat is the third. And then the horn from littleness comes, and at that point we have a great crisis. Then in Daniel chapter 11 we have the same two kingdoms described, Persia and Greece. And then we have the crisis in verses 21 to 35 of chapter 11. And then we jump to a still greater crisis in verse 36 and following, again in chapter 11. Now, there's much more we could say about chapter 8, but I want to have a few minutes at least on the four verses which are found in Daniel chapter 9, specifically verses 24 to 27. Now, in Daniel chapter 9, we have a great prayer which Daniel gives in response to a prophecy given by Jeremiah that Jerusalem would be desolate for 70 years. When does that desolation begin? Does the desolation begin with the destruction of the city, 586 BC, or does it begin with the great destruction in the territory nearby and the great number of people taken into captivity at the same time Daniel was taken into captivity, generally put around 605 BC? It is pretty hard to be sure when those 70 years actually began. But in chapter 9, we find that Daniel, after the Babylonian Empire has been destroyed and Darius the Mede has taken over as Cyrus's representative, we find Daniel prays. He figures it had been about 70 years since he was taken into exile with others in Jerusalem and that the territory around Jerusalem had been desolate. Now he could pray as follows, O God, you said there would be 70 years of desolation. Now is the time we can go back to our homeland. We can reestablish the glory of Jerusalem. We can have these things established as they were told before. He doesn't say a prayer like that, but rather he says, and here I'm quoting, Oh, we are a sinful nation. We deserve what you have meted out to us. And we are still sinful, end quote. And so, what is the Lord going to do? And so, the greater part of chapter 9 is made up of this great prayer, and then God sends an angel to Daniel to bring him an answer. And the angel gives him an answer in four verses, verses 24 to 27, which have been argued about perhaps as much as any four verses in the Bible. And there's much in these four verses that is not clear at all. And there are about six views that are held, and held very tenaciously, I might say, by the various individuals who hold each view. People become very emotional that their view is correct, but most of those who interpret these four verses, Daniel chapter 9, verses 24 to 27, most who do so approach it with a definite idea in mind. And then they try to fit everything else into that definite idea of theirs. Now, there are two definite ideas that are widely held. There are those who say these verses must tell us exactly how many years it would be before Christ would come. Now, that would be a very strange thing if 400 years in advance, Daniel told us exactly when Christ would come. That would be a very strange thing, because we do not find predictions like that anywhere else in Scripture. God could do that if he chose, but we have no right to assume that he did that, and no right to twist the statements around in order to force them into giving us an exact number of years from the time of Daniel to the time when Christ would appear. I would say we have no right to do that. There are others who say we must do it, or at least we do it without saying anything about it. Just insist that it occurs, but I say we should not approach it with such a presupposition. We should look at the passage and try to see what is there, and then when we do, we should emphasize what is clear first and then try to fit in what is less clear. That, I feel, is the only reasonable way to approach this passage, or any other passage for that matter. Now, I see that I have already discussed what I have called Part A of the outline, capital A, quote, the situation, end quote, by discussing the prayer and Daniel's answer coming to him. This is the situation. Verse 24 tells about the purpose. Verse 24 says that, quote, 70 weeks are determined upon your people and upon your holy city to finish the transgression, to make an end of sins, to make reconciliation for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up the vision of the prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. Notice there are six things spoken of here, six phrases, six conditions. Now I ask you for today to look at these six conditions and to see exactly what you think they mean and whether there is a definite order. Many commentaries will insist that the first three phrases of verse 24 are paralleled by the last three. The first by the fourth, the second by the fifth, and the third by the sixth. And I think that is entirely contrived. So I was interested to see how many of you would suggest that sort of thing, that sort of an arrangement, just by looking at these passages. And there were one or two papers that were given to me last Wednesday which said that the first three are negative conditions and the last are positive conditions. And that is an important observation. You can say that there are three that are rather negative. They speak of destroying sin. And then number four speaks of bringing in everlasting righteousness. So it might be divided into two threes on that basis. That is, two sections, three verses each section, or three clauses each section, three conditions each section. But to say that one corresponds to four, or section two to five, or three to six, you find dogmatically stated in many commentaries, and I do not think it is warranted. I should mention, however, at this point that there is another approach that is taken that does not contradict the first false approach I just mentioned, and that is to say this must point exactly to the time of Christ. Many make the assumption that this passage must look to the first coming of Christ and to nothing else. Now, there are a number of books written in recent years that take that assumption, which assume it can point to nothing else but the first coming of Christ. Now, we notice that in the other chapters, except chapter 8, the other three visions all look specifically to the time of the complete destruction of human government. And we have not found in the book of Daniel any other clear prediction anywhere else in these four verses of the first coming of Christ. Therefore, to assume that these verses must only point to the first coming of Christ is quite unwarranted. I believe they do point to the first coming of Christ, but to assume that that's all they point to is quite unwarranted. And there are many who interpret the statement in verse 27, which says, quote, he will put an end to sacrifice and offering, end quote, or, quote, he will cause sacrifice and oblation to cease, end quote, as meaning that Christ, by his death on the cross, put an end to sacrifice and offering. But it seems to me that this is taking an assumption and reading it into the text, because we have the statements in two other places in Daniel how the little horn is going to cause sacrifice and offering to cease, referring to his putting an end to them. To say that in this case it means that Christ, by his death on Calvary, will cause sacrifice and offering to cease is quite out of parallel with what you find elsewhere in the book of Daniel. These other chapters point very definitely to the second coming of Christ. It would be strange if there was nothing in this chapter, in this particular prediction, that pointed to that also. So that doesn't prove it, but to assume it points only to the first coming is utterly unwarranted, in my opinion. Now, as you look at these purposes, these six purposes or clauses that I mentioned before, some of them have been interpreted in many different ways. And I believe that to approach the passage, we should emphasize what is clear and then fit in what is less clear, and consequently, I believe that we should place considerable emphasis on the third purpose, or on the third phrase, which in the NIV is, quote, to atone for wickedness, end quote. In the King James Version, it says, quote, to make reconciliation for iniquity, end quote. But this word, reconciliation, used in the King James Version, is used about 70 times in the Old Testament to mean atone, and there are only four cases where this word is translated reconciliation in the King James Version. I don't know why they did it in this passage, because there is no passage I know of where it means to reconcile in today's sense. Perhaps in the time of King James, the meaning would fit. But today, if I reconcile you or reconcile with you, it simply means I make each of you stop thinking false things about the other and become friends again. And that's not what this term means. This term means, when one is at fault, to provide some way of remedying the fault so that they can be friends again. In other words, an atonement. It is used constantly in the Old Testament in connection with the sacrificial system, the making of atonement. This is the standard word for atonement, and so I don't know why the King James Version in this particular case translated it, quote, to make reconciliation, end quote. The word definitely means atonement, and in the few cases where it is not used in connection with the sacrificial system, it is used of somebody making somebody else friends with him again by repaying him for something or making up for something he's done to hurt him. So that is the exact parallel in meaning in the few cases where this word is used in relation to people or to what it means in our relationship with God. So this third statement, quote, to make an atonement for sin, end quote, it seems to me, we can say, is definite proof that this passage, the only one in the book of Daniel, does look to the first coming of Christ. I think we can say that positively from the third purpose. And then when you look at the first, second, and fourth purposes, or phrases, they are read in the King James as, quote, to finish transgressions, to put an end to sin, to bring in everlasting righteousness, end quote. Now, there have been various interpretations of these phrases. I know of one very fine Christian writer who insists that they all describe what Jesus Christ did at his first coming. He makes one of them, quote, getting rid of wickedness, end quote, described as when Jesus went into the temple and drove out the money changers, for instance. Now, it seems to me this is a rather small thing to make in view of these great purposes here described in Daniel. But there are a number of writers now who insist that all these phrases, all these conditions must refer to the first coming of Christ. But these three purposes, again I quote them, to finish transgression, to put an end to sin, to bring in everlasting righteousness, end quote, seem to me must refer to that which is stressed elsewhere in Daniel, to the complete end of the reign of wickedness over the world, with the complete destruction of the statue and the complete destruction of the fourth beast. So I think we can say that we can reasonably expect to find clear references to both the first advent and to the second advent of Christ in this passage. I see I got ahead of my outline there. I mentioned that second advent, some or all of the first, second, and fourth purposes. Now, we also have time period mentioned here. We have 7 years, which looks like a sabbatical year. We have seven sevens, followed by the Jubilee year. I feel it is utterly wrong to say they can't be precise periods, but we have no right dogmatically to assume they are precise periods. It is also possible to approach this with the question, quote, are these years an exact number, or are they general periods of time, end quote. And some very good interpreters have taken this latter view. Now, number two of the outline, quote, is the anointed one in verse 25 Christ or Cyrus, end quote. I believe that is important. Isaiah chapter 44, verses 26 to 45 says, quote, Cyrus will rebuild Jerusalem. He will rebuild my city. He is my anointed, end quote. This very term, Messiah or anointed, is used of Cyrus. And so we have no right to assume that this word Messiah is used only for Christ. Messiah is used both in 25 and verse 26. In verse 25, it may mean Christ, but not necessarily, but I believe it does mean Christ in verse 26. But in verse 25, we have no right to assume it is either case without examination. And certainly no right to assume that in 25. So one must be careful to examine each reference in its context rather than making sweeping generalizations based on a theory imposed on a text. Well, I'm afraid that'll have to be enough for today. We will pick up more discussion of these four verses, chapter 9, verses 24 to 28, next time. This is the end of lecture number 12, The Prophecies of Daniel, by Alan McCrae.